Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Anti-government protesters in Sudan continue to call for the ouster of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. He has ruled the country for 30 years. Al-Bashir has declared a year-long state of emergency, banned protests, and gave sweeping power to security forces. He's also handed over the running of the ruling National Congress Party to his deputy and supporter, Ahmed Haroun. Joining us to talk about the latest is Hannah Baba, a reporter and co-host of Cross Currents, a daily radio news magazine that broadcasts here on KALW in San Francisco. Last month, Hannah returned from Khartoum, the capital city, where she spent 3 weeks visiting her family. Hi, Hannah. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Before we dive in and talk about the latest, Hannah, because this is not getting much attention unless you really search for it, can you remind us why these protests began back in December?
Sure. Well, the protests began, the immediate reason for why people started protesting was because the government had lifted subsidies on bread and on gasoline. So fuel prices went up, bread prices went up, bakeries were charging an arm and a leg for this very basic thing, which was bread. So that was kind of the immediate reason why people took to the streets. But then it grew, and like you mentioned, this has been 30 years of a dictatorship. So there is a lot more than bread to protest about. And so slowly this turned into a protest against the ruling, you know, the President al-Bashir himself. And people were starting to say, well, wait a minute, is this really just about bread? Mm. Or is this about something deeper, something more? And since then, it's been a call for him to step down, a call for the whole government to step down, and a call for democracy. So that's kind of what started it all since December.
And also for a little more context, Hannah, you know, when we say that this country is run by a dictator, what does that mean exactly in Sudan? For example, what is it like for people in terms of freedom of expression?
Sure. So this, the military came to power in 1989 through a coup, and they overthrew a democratically elected government. And what that means for people on a daily basis is, you mentioned freedom of expression. There is no freedom of expression. The laws that are implemented in Sudan are very, very, very strict laws in terms of expression, in terms of the press, in terms of even things like public order, quote unquote, right? Like how you dress, what you look, how you behave in public, because it's a dictatorship and it's the military, but they came in along with the Islamist parties of Sudan back in 1989, who were kind of ushered this military in. So it is it's freedom, but it's also this idea that if you're not one of us, you're not going to get anywhere. Hmm. Right? They came in and they immediately started firing anybody who was not within their party, not going along with it. And so it's 30 years later, and now you have a whole country of people who are with the government, or, you know, people who are kind of numbed at this point, I think, to a lot of what these laws, you know, are doing to the country. But it's a matter of democracy and freedom. Those are the two things that people are calling for right now.
Al-Bashir has declared a state of emergency. He has banned so-called unauthorized protests, but people are still taking to the streets. And last time you were on, you said that people could get shot. I mean, they're really willing to take that risk. They've reached that level. A couple of weeks later, what is it like now, especially now that he's declared this state of emergency?
So people are still protesting, like you mentioned. The organizers of the protests are still heavily organizing, sending out, like, schedules of protests this week. Monday, you know, in this area, Tuesday in this area, and these are widely spread right now over social media, people are getting shot. People are getting jailed. You know, people are getting tear gassed inside their homes still. None of this has stopped. Yet they're still going out to the streets. And I think that's what people, you know, observers are saying is amazing about this movement, is that even these emergency laws are in place and the organizing hasn't stopped. Now, what has happened is that they've set up these emergency law courts. So they are taking people in kind of under that. But they were jailing people before. So, you know, a lot of people are like, well, this has been happening. What's really new? So people feel it's like a fear tactic. It's a scare tactic to say, oh, there are these emergency laws and we have these courts and we will take you in, whereas this has been happening all along.
The AP reports that, according to the doctors' union, at least 57 people have been killed. The union said 28 doctors have been detained. One was shot while treating wounded protesters. Where are you going, Hana, to get information about how many people have been hurt and how many have been killed?
Right. I mean, the official numbers do come in from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch. Those are kind of the official numbers that we see. Sudanese government, of course, always kind of skews low in numbers. So what I look at is really the people that are organizing this group called the Sudanese Professionals Association, which is, you know, it has the physicians groups and the engineers, and it's like all of these unions have come together to organize, and they're very strong right now. They're the ones who are leading all of this movement and showing people what to do when. So we go with their numbers. They have people on the ground everywhere. They're the ones shooting the video of the people who get shot, or somebody who's taken to the hospital, or somebody whose child. There was a very, very sad situation a couple of days ago where a security truck, they have this thing where they just go into a neighborhood and start just like ramming here, just like going around the neighborhood very fast with their vehicles. And they hit who they hit. They don't care. Yeah. So one of these vehicles rammed inside a home where a family was sleeping, and there were two children. One of the children sadly died in hospital. And so those are the sources that you don't get to hear abroad a lot. They are a lot of it, and it is in Arabic. There is a group now called the Sudanese Translators Group on Twitter. They're trying to take any and all video that comes out of Sudan and translate it, right, for international media. But it's hard. It's hard to get real numbers when you have total chaos, when you have a press that isn't free in the country, right? Journalists are jailed right now as we speak. There was two newspapers that were shut down last week. So the truth is very, very hard to discern.
We're talking about what is happening in Sudan with Hana Baba, a reporter and co-host of Cross Currents, a daily radio news magazine that broadcasts here on KALW. She was in Sudan last month visiting family. I want to also ask you about the role that women are playing, Hana, because like you said, there's some coverage out there, but you really have to search for it. And it looks like this is coming from Channel 4 News, which is in the UK, right? And then Reuters has a piece called Sudanese Security Forces Use Tear Gas to Break Up Women's Protests. Sudanese Security Forces used tear gas on Sunday to break up a crowd of hundreds of people, mostly young women, demonstrating against the detention of women arrested at previous protests. The protesters chanted, "Long live the struggle of Sudanese women," and "Down, that's it," one of the main slogans calling for the fall of Omar al-Bashir. Let's talk about the role that the women are playing.
Women are at the forefront of this uprising, and they've always been at the forefront in Sudan's revolutions. In 1985 and 1964, Sudan was one of the first countries to have a woman parliamentarian in the region, a woman judge. So we're progressive in that way. Women have always had a say in politics in Sudan. And women are also very educated. So our universities, more than half of the student population is always girls, women and girls. So it wasn't a surprise or a shock to us that women would take a huge role in this. Women's groups across the country, across the world, are also supporting this movement. And the students, university students, videos, so many videos of these young ladies with their scarves across their noses, right, because they're being tear gassed. These amazing pictures and images coming out of Sudan of just like you would see like 100 or more of these young ladies, colorful scarves, and they're just chanting with their flags in their hands and being tear gassed, right, and being jailed. Mm. My cousin was one of them. I have a cousin who was taken from one of the protests. We didn't know where she was for like almost 3 or 4 days until they called and said she's in this jail. That, you know, and there was a jail at one point that had 500 women, these young ladies, jailed. And so, and the grandmothers, there was a posting the other day, you know, the grandmothers of the revolution, and it's these old women with their flags just kind of walking with their walkers and canes. And you know, International Women's Day is coming up, so the organizers also have kind of claimed it as Sudan Women Protest Day. Hmm. Women will go out. And so it's energizing, you know, for somebody to see your sister, your mom, your daughter out there. Everybody's energized, and women have always been at the forefront, and they're doing it now again. So it's very, very... It's dangerous, and it's scary, but it's exciting, and it's an exciting moment that everybody wants to be a part of.
Why isn't this getting more attention, Hana? I was just searching on the New York Times website. They had a piece at the end of January called The Strong and Beautiful Message of Sudan's Young Protesters. Several articles in January, not so many in February. What explains, and only one actually in the entire month of February. Here we are March 1st, and these protests are still going strong. What explains the lack of coverage?
Girl, if you find the answer, you tell me. I mean, it's frustrating. It's very frustrating that we're not in the news cycle. This issue is not in the news cycle anymore, and it's frustrating to the people on the ground. A lot of people here in the U.S. and the U.K., expats and immigrants are starting to like organize in terms of, guys, you know, let's make press releases. The Sudanese American Physician Association sent out, you know, to the media here, and they're not getting any interest. And so they come to somebody like me, right? I'm one of the very few kind of community members in media. Hmm. Asking, what does it take to get, you know, CNN or NPR or any of these organizations doing a story on this? What is it? You're inside, you know. And then we talk about editorial process, and which is an interesting thing as well. You know, as somebody in the news department myself, what is it that we choose to cover?
Right.
And what do we choose to not ignore, but when does something not become interesting anymore, right? And that's something that we need to discuss in our journalist circles as well. Is it always when something is happening first and then it kind of falls off, and why? Mm. Right? Where is that continuity? This revolution, quote unquote, is still going on and it's still happening. Why is there no interest in it anymore, or have other things, you know, kind of pushed it to the back of the bus?
Well, I just did search on NPR, a story on January 4th, January 6th, and that's about it. There was one.
And that's it.
And that's it. There was one in late February based on a UN report that says every kind of norm is broken. UN says brutality in South Sudan may rise to war crimes. So hardly anything on NPR.
Hardly anything on NPR, American media overall. And, you know, again, sadly, it's a matter of it's not interesting anymore. Maybe other news have come and kind of pushed to the front. You know, we have the Cohen hearings, maybe. I don't know. But it's very interesting to explore. And it's that's why I don't go to a CNN or an NPR or a Washington Post or a New York Times anymore. The organizations that are doing the reporting now that I look to are things like Middle East Eye. They've been doing a very good job. And what is that? It's just a group of freelance reporters who have come together and created this news site. Hmm. They have great reporting. So Middle East-based organizations are doing the reporting. Channel 4 is great. Why? Because I think a big reason is because one of its main reporters is a Sudanese woman. Hmm. Her name is Yusra Al-Baghir. She's the sister of Nima Al-Baghir, who is a CNN, very, very famous CNN reporter. She's doing a lot of great work over there. So maybe it takes us actually being in the news organizations, and that takes us to diversity in news.
Exactly.
Which is another issue for another day.
No, it's so true, Hana, because, you know, I was just thinking, would we cover this if you weren't here at KALW? I hope we would. But who knows?
But
I mean, I think that
you never know.
We don't know. The problem is Cohen. I mean, we're going to talk about Cohen today because we're going to try to do a little different coverage. But Donald Trump has just taken up so much of the space across all media outlets.
Yeah. So just wanted to let people know also that there is a West Coast march and protest held by Sudanese from California, but also folks are coming from Oregon, Arizona, all these other places. In San Francisco, that's March 30th. There was a huge one on the East Coast. Thousands of people came from up and down I-95, Ohio, everywhere. They shut down downtown D.C., essentially. And so let's see if the Bay Area media come out to the May 30th at San Francisco City Hall.
Yeah,
March 30th. Sorry.
Good question. And a few more questions quickly, Hana.
Sure.
What is the significance of Omar Bashir handing over the running of the ruling National Congress Party to his deputy and big supporter, Ahmed Haroon?
I mean, he is trying to, because these protests are strong and continuing, and I think this is a concession that he thinks he's making, where everybody's asking for his stepping down, but really people are asking for the government to step down. So for you to take a governor of a state and to say, this is my deputy, who is also wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes in Darfur, as the president is, isn't doing much. So a lot of people are saying, you know, meh, it's, you know, same. It's the same, unless it's not a real change, and people are not expecting a real change at all.
You've got relatives there. You have friends there. What are you hearing from them if people don't expect a real change? How long? I mean, what are their plans from here on out?
I mean, that's a good question. A lot of debate and a lot of discussion is happening right now about kind of, okay, well, what's next? And the answer seems to be patience, patience, patience. Some leaders are emerging, but they're careful about not being too vocal so they don't get jailed, right? Because the Sudanese Professional Association that's leading all of this is being very careful not to put certain characters or personalities out there because their lives will be in danger. So it seems like the people are fed up enough that they are willing to do this every day. This is now, they're going into their third month with the hope, I think, that they will wear this government down, because there are signs that all of these kind of this concession of Ahmed Haroon coming in and some other things that have been happening, you know, they feel like they're making a dent. And it feels good to make a dent, and they're being patient. But there's a lot of questions about, okay, then, you know, what's next and how long are we able to be patient?
Well, Hana, we will definitely continue to cover this. In fact, maybe we should do an entire show on what's happening in Sudan. Thank you for your reporting. And we'll have you on. Thank you for your reporting. Thanks for keeping us aware of what's going on there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Have a good weekend. That's Hana Baba. She's a reporter and co-host of Cross Currents, a daily radio news magazine that broadcasts here on KALW in San Francisco. Last month, she returned from Khartoum, the capital city of Sudan, a population of 42 million people, and half are under 19. So definitely watch, search for stories about these anti-government protests, and we will continue to follow this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Now we are going to talk about Michael Cohen's testimony. On Wednesday, Donald Trump's former lawyer testified before the House Oversight Committee, and it was damning testimony. He said, quote, "I'm ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Trump's illicit acts. I'm ashamed because I know what Trump is. He's a racist. He's a con man. He's a cheat," end quote. So this is getting 24/7 coverage. We're going to drill down to talk about what was actually revealed and what is next. Joining us is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several best-selling books, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report, focused on what politicians do rather than what they say. And David's got a piece, Cohen's testimony is a roadmap of Trump's multiple crimes, but the Democrats need to do a better job connecting the dots. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Rose, for having me.
It's great to have you back. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Great to have both of you. So let's dive in. What really stood out for you in this testimony, David K. Johnston?
Well, by my count, there were at least 14 criminal matters to be pursued, including bank fraud, charity fraud, income tax fraud at the state and federal levels, property tax fraud, et cetera, and the prospect of a 15th. The problem is that the testimony wasn't presented in an organized manner. The examination of the witness was marred, except for three members of Congress, by a lot of preening for the cameras by the Democrats. And, of course, the Republicans were all preening for the cameras. What we need are more of something called soup questions. In the movie Finding Forrester, the character Sean Connery plays is a famous reclusive writer. Says a soup question elicits information that we need to know, that matters to us. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Katie Hill of California, and I'll mispronounce his last name, the gentleman from Illinois whose ancestors are from India, they asked some pretty good questions, but the rest of the questioners were just not up to the par that's needed here, and perhaps staff lawyers should be doing these examinations instead of each congressperson getting their 5 minutes of fame.
And it's so interesting because those three are freshman Democratic lawmakers. I'll take a stab. I think it's Raja Krishnamurthy.
Krishnamurthy, I think, is the right way to pronounce it, although when I was on TV with him last night, it sounded different. That's why I'm being hesitant.
Well, and we'll dive in and talk about what these three asked and what they revealed to further the testimony. But before we go to break, Scott, what really stood out for you?
Well, I agree with what David says here. So, and I think it did highlight a number of crimes. I'd add, I think bank fraud and insurance fraud also were thrown out there in addition.
Yep.
I think it was a good mapping exercise. So I think one thing that did come out effectively in the questioning was identifying where documents and information could be found and who possessed other information. So I think we've got a list of names of individuals who we can expect to be called in. But
right.
But David's main point is exactly correct. As if you really wanted to do this as a serious investigation, you wouldn't be doing it in front of the cameras. You would be having professional staff questioning them in a room where they could just follow bang, 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 bang up on all these issues. This was something that was done more as an exercise in public education than a real investigation.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org and can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news with 1A from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about coverage of Michael Cohen's testimony, Donald Trump's former lawyer. It was damning testimony, and we're going to talk about what was actually revealed and where does this go from here. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of many bestsellers, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. He's founder and editor-in-chief of DC Report, a nonprofit news service focused on what politicians do rather than what they say. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Let's talk about actually what was revealed. One thing that I keep hearing in the media is that, oh, we didn't learn anything new. We've been hearing about this stuff for months. Okay, but it's important to still talk about it, because our attention spans are so short now with so much news coming out, and to talk about the significance. So the Washington Post had a short list of what they thought was most important. And David, I know you've got your piece, but let's just still go into the details. So the Washington Post pointed out that Cohen alleged that Trump knew in advance that WikiLeaks planned to publish the hacked DNC emails. He detailed how deeply and personally involved Trump was in the scheme to pay off Stormy Daniels, who said that she had an affair with Trump. He suggested that federal prosecutors are investigating unspecified criminal allegations involving Donald Trump that have not been made public. What else would you add to that list, David?
Well, I think the smoking gun here is that $35,000 check that Vanity Fair's Emily Jane Fox reported Cohen went and found after Lanny Davis or someone told him, you know, who's going to believe you? That's a personally signed check by Donald Trump, and his only possible defense for it is that's a retainer agreement, but it didn't go into what's called the IOLA account, the trust fund account of Michael Cohen. That check is really crucial. And then the second thing are the financial statements. I have a piece that they're editing right now at the Daily Beast about the financial statements. Back in 1990, I got my hands on Donald's financial statement that showed he wasn't a billionaire. He called me a liar for months until he had to put another financial statement on the record that showed he had a negative net worth. The financial statements show that Donald doubled his wealth in 2013 by just claiming that his brand is worth $4 billion. Well, you know, my name is my brand. I have a unique name among 7 billion people. And so, Rose, I want you to know my brand's worth $3 billion.
Well, and David, I mean, you have just meticulously looked at Trump's finances. I mean, we had you on the show a couple times talking about your book, It's Even Worse Than You Think. So,
and the making of Donald Trump before that.
Right, and the making of Donald Trump before that. So I mean, that's what really bugged me about this media theme that, well, no, this is nothing new. We've heard about this. But this is important. And as you point out, brand new Congresswoman, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I mean, she got a lot of attention, even in the New York Times. Caroline Frederickson, president of the American Constitution Society, had a piece called, as you said, "Too Many Representatives Chose to Bloviate Instead of Interrogate," except for Ocasio-Cortez. She asked pointed questions about Trump's tax returns and financial statements.
And she asked where to pursue them. As,
right.
as Scott pointed out earlier, roadmap. Where
right.
do we go from here? And you're going to see those people. I mean, this is only the first hearing. Elijah Cummings has been very clear, and they're going to be hearings by the other committees. And it's going to take time. You know, during Watergate, if it weren't for the hearings that Senator Sam Ervin held, where night after night after night you could go home and watch on PBS the full hearings, Nixon might have survived a long time.
Well, and so what she pointed out was, would it be helpful in finding out if Trump inflated the value of his assets to insurance companies or conversely deflated the value of assets like his golf course in order to keep his tax bill low?
Right. And well, we know that he's done this. It is literally, in fact, not new. Now it isn't me saying it or a reporter at the Lower Hudson Valley News. It is Donald Trump's lawyer, the guy who was doing the deals for him and doing his dirty work. That brings this to a whole new level. And my guess is he's got more and better documents than he realizes in his files.
And Scott, what does this reveal about just how this system is rigged for so many people? I mean, not just Donald Trump.
Well, that, you know, prominent, powerful people with lawyers, with intimidating lawyers and armies of accountants, are able to get away with things that others can't. And I've lived for the last 15 years in Westchester County, where Donald Trump has many, many properties, and I've just watched in the local news sort of outrage about him principally. Actually, he's the highest profile single individual, his golf course, his Briarcliff Manor property, and several others, where these things are given ridiculously low values when it comes to time for him to pay taxes, and then ridiculously high values when he's valuing his entire portfolio for purposes of getting insurance or a bank loan or something like that. And, you know, the remarkable thing is he's gotten away with it for so long. And let me go back also and add one more thing. I think a big point that came out from the hearing yesterday, and I would just call this, Donald Trump's lawyers are in trouble because, you know, we heard that that Cohen, before he went in and gave his false testimony in Congress, he sat down with Jay Sekulow, and his testimony was actually edited and reviewed. Now, that is the evidence he gave based on which he was later convicted for misleading Congress. This then puts one of Trump's lawyers right in the middle of it, and I think we have hints also of other members of the president's legal team being involved. And I, you know, I saw that, and my immediate reaction was, well, now I understand why so many people have left the Trump legal team.
Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of many bestsellers, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. He's also founder and editor-in-chief of DC Report, a nonprofit news service. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you make of the 24/7 coverage of Michael Cohen's testimony? What did you learn? What do you think is next? What would you like to see next? And you can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Patty in San Francisco. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I really don't know why anybody's so surprised. I mean, unlike many politicians, he's made it quite clear he's a crook. Why should anybody be surprised? These testimonies. When they indict the SOB, then that'll be news.
Well, we could say that about a lot of things, Patty. Why are we surprised about a lot of things? But the importance of getting this on the record, David, and the importance of Ocasio-Cortez's questions, would it be helpful in finding out if this happened? Would it be helpful in talking to Alan Weisberg, Trump's money man? Can you talk about the significance of just getting this out there and getting it on the record from someone like Michael Cohen?
Yeah, I understand Patty's cynicism about this, and it makes perfect sense if you've been paying attention to what's going on. But, you know, get in the car and drive from San Francisco to where I live now in Rochester, New York, and stop in Nebraska and Illinois and Michigan in towns where the factories are gone and people are much worse off than they were in the 1970s. The house I bought in East Lansing, Michigan in 1973 is worth less money today, adjusted for inflation, than it was back then, which certainly is the opposite of the Bay Area, for example. And you will find legions of people who believe that Donald Trump is a demigod, not a demagogue, a demigod, that he alone is saving them, that the Democrats are trying to suppress and hurt working class people and are the enemy of these people, and that Donald Trump is their hero, not just because he promises to make America white again, which it never was, but because he says he will fix their economics. He's not fixing their economics. He's hurting their economics. But when you are been down as long as millions of Americans have, and I wrote three books about how the rules of the government are creating this inequality that we have, focused less on the enormous government-subsidized growth of income and wealth at the top than it's suppressing the vast majority of Americans' incomes. These people are desperate. They are legitimately angry. And if they don't get the message, if we don't report this and report it again and again and again until it is ingrained into our brains the same way that Flo, the progressive insurance woman, is, Donald Trump could get a second term.
What would you add, Scott?
Well, I think David's message is essentially correct, and I think it goes back to what Abraham Lincoln said about the importance of public opinion in this entire process. So it's one thing to have the evidence. It's one thing to have sort of a vague sense that somebody's a crook or doesn't follow the best business practices. And it's something else, again, to see displayed on television a check which reflects a corrupt act with his signature on it. I mean, so having very clear evidence of criminal acts is really important, and it's really important in persuading people that this is a case in which outrage is appropriate and action is appropriate. And, you know, of course, the problem we've got here is, you know, we have this roughly 35% to 42% block in the public that just seems to be behind Trump no matter, and that he is resting on. I mean, that's really a remarkably low level of support for a president historically. But for Trump and for the Republicans, they feel comfortable with it. They think it's fine. And I think as a political matter, without cracking that base, it's going to be very, very difficult to force Trump from office, whatever the level of proof. So this entire public education process, and that really is the purpose of this hearing, is really very important. It's critical to our democracy.
And then,
and Rose, if I can just build on Scott's point for a second, the lowest number I have seen in any reputable poll of support for Donald Trump among likely Republican voters is 80%. So if you're a Republican politician and you go against Trump, there is a very high likelihood you will be voted out of office, and that explains this allegiance to Trump. Now, I'm disgusted by this. I want to be really clear. People died for this country. My father was a 100% disabled veteran of World War II who was in pain and discomfort every day of his life after the war until he died. Never complained either. But so my view is, you know, if you are such a coward that you're not willing to risk your office for the welfare of our country, then shame on you, and we should get rid of you. But the reality is, most politicians are cowards. They want to stay in office, and so they're going to kowtow so they don't lose in a primary.
Right. And Representative Adam Schiff from California is now going on television saying that behind closed doors, a lot of his Republican colleagues are seething over, you name it, about Donald Trump. But in public, they're supporting him 100% for exactly the reason you just described, David.
Yep.
And the other thing to point out is when these hearings happen, then you get really good journalists taking a piece of the hearing and expanding on it. So Catherine Rampell, who writes about economics for the Washington Post, said that to her, the biggest lesson was that we desperately need to increase the Internal Revenue Service's budget. She writes, Cohen repeatedly offered accounts of not only how comfortable Trump became with cheating Uncle Sam, but also how ill-equipped our tax cops were to catch him. She writes that the IRS has loosened over the years, especially when it comes to the ultra wealthy. Since 2011, the audit rate for large corporations, with at least $10 million in assets, has halved. For households with income of more than $1 million, it's declined by 2/3. Federal prosecutors referred by the IRS have plunged to their lowest level on record. What about that, David?
Well, I wrote a best-selling book about this, Perfectly Legal. This has been a long-term trend. And it is accelerated when the Republicans got control of Congress. It is a real fundamental problem. My next book, which I'm almost done with, proposes a new tax system that will solve these problems, if you think I got it right. But it's an absolute reality. Wealthy people who are in control of their finances, like Donald Trump, have virtually no risk of being caught in a civil audit and none in a criminal audit. You know, we have 160 million what the government calls tax units in America. That's households, some of which don't have to file tax returns because their incomes are so small. Hmm. How many criminal cases do we bring every year for tax fraud at the federal level? Around 1,600, most of which are connected to drug dealing or bribes.
Wow.
There is no serious effort to go after tax cheats like Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is absolutely a national class tax cheat, criminal tax cheat.
Scott?
I think absolutely. In fact, even the rationale that was being advanced for not turning over his tax records, that he was subject to an audit. I mean, we've now heard several suggestions, some of them coming from Cohen, that he, in fact, was not under audit. That was simply wrong. But, you know, if he hasn't been under audit, how it is that he's got away with everything he's gotten away with, things that the New York Times, for instance, has brought up and documented in great detail, and things that came out in the course of Cohen's testimony yesterday concerning property valuations. I mean, if he's been audited, he hasn't been audited effectively, and that's been something that's been going on for 20 years now.
David, how pervasive is this for wealthy people to deflate the value of their assets in order to keep their tax bills low?
It varies with the nature of individuals. Among corporations that are approached for tax shelters, there are companies that say, don't you darken our front door, and there are others that say, please, let's give you some caviar where you tell us how to cheat the taxpayers. I mean, these things vary according to who people are, but those people who choose to cheat, who are in control of their income, that is, they're not employees, they own their own businesses, especially on the international level like Trump, they get away with whatever they want to get away with. And this is just a fundamental real problem. And, you know, during the campaign, I and a number of other people, Scott may have even been one of them, asked to see the audit letter. The audit letter is an anodyne document. It just says, you know, you're under audit. It doesn't tell you what for. It just tells you the year and would indicate if it was his personal return or some other. Trump refused to provide such a letter. He could have been under audit for a gift to his grandchildren, something totally and completely minor. Donald never intended to make his tax returns available, but thanks to a 1924 anti-corruption law, we are going to see them. Congress, since 1924, has exercised routinely its right to look at tax returns of corporations and individuals. They do this all the time at the Joint Committee on Taxation, and we will see Donald Trump's tax returns.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and founder and editor of the nonprofit news service DC Report. He's the author of many bestsellers, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Warfare. Let's go next to Mark in San Jose. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I had a question about, for me, the tax return and the tax issue was really prominent because it looks like we're going in two directions here. One is the Russia investigation, and then the other is all of the domestic stuff that is being handled wisely by other prosecutors. And I think the whole idea that IRS isn't really doing the right job here is right on. I think we really need to look at that, and I think we really need to get to kind of a tax return system that's more like Europe uses, where it's actually automatic, and you don't have all these deductions and everything at the end of the year, and it doesn't become this great, you know, let's get all our fraud, you know, stuff together at one time, but it's more of an ongoing process, and people are monitored on an ongoing process, perhaps with different, you know, deadlines throughout the year to spread it out. But I think we also need to look at some other fundamental changes, like constitutional changes, because they may be required for campaign finance reform with the current Supreme Court, but also with things like, you know, anybody running for national office needs to submit these tax returns this number of years before you run. You could try to pass that by legislation, but it might not make it through the Supreme Court. So I think we need to start looking at that and look at it very seriously.
Thank you, Mark. David, what are your thoughts?
Well, I hope Mark is going to buy my book when it comes out, which I'm tentatively calling the Prosperity Tax. I may call the Smart Tax because he's right about this. Verified income. In California, many people do not have to file tax return because there's something called Ready File, and it has a 98% approval rating among people who have used it. I've long said that we should require the disclosure of at least 6 years of tax returns for anybody who is seriously on the ballot for President of the United States. And I think that's a fundamental basic reform. And another really good reform would be no member of Congress or the Senate may receive any campaign contribution or assistance from anyone outside of the jurisdiction they represent. Mm-hmm. You live in California, you call my congressperson here in New York, they're not going to listen to you. Well, then why should my congressperson be able to take money from people in San Francisco?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you for calling in, Mark. And we'll definitely have David back to really just talk about taxes in light of learning that Amazon paid no federal income taxes. There's a couple other pieces I'd love to talk with you about again, David. The U.S. banks made $28 billion in extra profits thanks to the Republican tax bill. We're still learning about how that's playing out. So I'd like to talk to you about that on a different show. But we have about a couple minutes left, and I'm wondering, Scott, what are your thoughts about where this is going from here? The Times has a piece called Why Alan Weisselberg, Trump's Money Man, Could Face Scrutiny Next. He was Donald Trump's chief financial officer. So where do you think this is going next?
I think that's exactly where it's going. I think he's going to be center stage in the next phase of these hearings. And I think we are looking at, you know, I think the Russia investigation is going forward. We didn't get to hear too much about that in this last hearing because it was off bounds for questioning. There's quite a bit there, but there's also quite a bit of overlay between that and these questions about taxes, financing, and assets, because we know an awful lot of his business was being financed by dark money, and a lot of that dark money was coming from Russia. So, you know, actually disclosure of taxes and his personal financials may be very, very important in this regard. But I think what we're going to see now is what one reporter has recently called a proctological examination of the Trump organization. I think there is going to be a deep scrutiny of its finances, its money, where it's gotten money, since it's operated largely without bank financing since the last spate of bankruptcies, and how it's treated and valued its assets. That's going to be scrutinized very, very closely. And that may lead to criminal charges, not just from the Department of Justice and the U.S. attorneys, but from the states that are involved. And that's something I think it'll be much more difficult for Trump to wriggle out of, and something for which he has no immunity as president.
David, what would you add?
Well, I think Scott is exactly right on in his observations. Remember, there are multiple committees at work here, and all of these things blend together as one. Trump's money, his connections, the leverage that the Russians and apparently the Saudis have over him because of his past dealings. And what I worry about is that Donald is a deeply mentally ill person. He's someone who has never known a day of happiness in his life. I mean, try to find a video of Donald smiling that isn't a forced laugh, and you won't find one. he has behaved, as I predicted, increasingly erratically. And we should be very worried that now, in two different occasions, the murder of Americans by foreign autocrats, the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and now the young preppy Warmbier, Otto Warmbier, by foreign governments, resulted in Donald, you know, in being in denial and saying, well, in the case of Kim, he says he didn't do it, and I take him at his word. This is sixth-grade gullibility. Luckily, we haven't had a major crisis, but if we do, Donald is not up to the task. He doesn't know what to do. And as a con man, we've got to bring this to an end, because he is a clear and present danger, not only to us, but to the whole world.
What is legally possible, just quickly, David? I mean, if Michael Cohen is going to prison for 3 years for crimes that included arranging payments to silence women who said they had affairs with Trump,
right,
what does that mean exactly? I mean, if he's going to prison for doing that,
right,
what about the person who asked him to do it?
Well, because of a memo designed to get Spiro Agnew, it was a crook, out of the White House, we've had this Justice Department rule that's been updated that you can't indict a sitting president. I don't think that's true, but you don't take my word for it. People like Barbara Ranofsky and Lawrence Tribe of Harvard, who've written books about this, say this is utter nonsense, but that's clearly going to be the policy. Nothing prevents the New York State Attorney General, who has promised to be vigorously in pursuit of Trump, from indicting him. Nothing prevents the prosecutor in Manhattan, Cyrus Vance, who so far has shown himself to be a complete coward when it comes to Trump, to indict him. But what's most likely to happen is what happened with Nixon. Remember that ultimately every single member of Congress, the last man standing was Congressman Sandman, turned against Nixon. What the Republicans who are seething in private, and they are, I know I've talked to some Republicans and private, they're like, how to get out of this? Is they're worried. We've got to get enough information in the record that the public's revulsion level rises, and Republicans can begin separating themselves, as you've seen begin to happen for the very first time now with the emergency declaration about the border. Mm.
Scott, final thoughts, about 30 seconds.
I just say, if it's 3 to 5 years for Michael Cohen, then under the existing guidelines, the principal who pushed him to do it gets 5 to 8 years, and that's the law.
Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott, thanks so much for joining us again.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of many books, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is also founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. David, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you for having Scott on.
Yes, it was great to have both of you together. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls Media Roundtable.